Monday.
Keep going.
So good to me.
So good to me.
You would have been a good mama and papa.
What are you saying?
If they would have... I'm just saying the band is called the Mamas and Papas.
Michelle Phillips or Mama Cass?
I think you would have been a nice compliment to the entire group. A cohesive that would have kept them together for years and years and years.
I'm a cohesive.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi, guys. It's Bill. It's Wendy. Welcome to the show. Eric Zorn will stop by later. And also a serious discussion about pancreatic cancer. We heard last week that Alex Trebek is suffering from...
Oh, boy, right.
That song ended quickly. That song just ended very abruptly. So, yeah, we'll talk about that
yeah,
later on in
the show. Yeah, that's
scary. Getting back to something Steve Cochran was discussing, most of his show had to do with quirks that you might have, something that might make you a little bit different from the rest of the pack. Don't you think just by virtue of the fact that you know you have something like that, that's a good thing, right? Like if you had one of those quirks and you didn't know it, or didn't think it was quirky, that would be bad. But if you accept it and you go, yeah, here's how I'm different from the rest, I think that's a positive, don't you?
Well, there's nothing you have to do about it.
Right.
You have some quirks. We all have.
Oh, I have. Everybody does.
I feel like there's not a person that has no quirks.
I can't think of anybody.
Everybody has a little. I bet Bertrand has a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a lot of quirks.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of them. I'm sure I do. I mean, I have a lot of them I'm not going to discuss with the two of you.
But you know, here's what's interesting. On my way in, I stopped and talked to some of the people in the office. And everybody could come up with, and this was by my design. I said, I bet you can name more that your spouse has than yourself. And it was the case
for
everybody.
Because you're more critical of them.
Right.
Or observant.
That's what happened to me this morning when I know. Figured out. My husband went crazy. He's texting me.
Eats chicken with a fork and a knife.
You were throwing him under the CTA traffic bus there.
The fork eating pizza drives me banana.
Although if it's a deep dish... That's acceptable.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm talking the thinnest kind of pizza. He can't just pick it up with his finger.
Mary, when you first saw that years ago, you weren't married to him yet, obviously, and you first saw that, how did you react to that? You saw him eating what would be normally considered finger food with a fork.
It was an acquired thing. I don't know when it happened. But
oh, it wasn't always like that?
Oh, no.
My Jim did that, too. The very first date we had that I cooked him dinner, I made ribs for him, and he ate them and got them all over his... He was wearing shorts. It was on his knee. It was everywhere. Probably not a good first date food. But now he cannot eat chicken with bones in it. And I said, why? And he goes, because it looks like a chicken. I go, why can you eat ribs?
Because
I don't know.
It doesn't look
because they taste better. It totally looks like
it looks
a slab
like ribs,
of ribs,
but it doesn't look like an animal.
And ribs don't have a leg or a breast,
right?
But he will only eat like boneless
chicken fingers. You're saying,
yeah. When we do chicken parties in my family at our beach club,
yes.
We get fried chicken, and my sister has to get the chicken tenders for the kids and Jim.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I've told you this before, and I don't know if everyone does this. I know I do this. You fool yourself. Whatever food you're eating, I know that a hamburger used to be a cow. I know that that bacon used to be a pig. But you have to fool yourself into believing, no, it's always been a hamburger, or it's been bacon, or it's been...
I just don't think about it. I think how good it is.
Well, I think about it exactly. Of course it was a cow. That's why the cow was raised and we eat. And
yeah, but you think about that every time you have a burger?
Well, no, but I don't try not to think about it.
I just think, wow, it's a burger. I don't like to think from whence it came.
But that's what I mean. You're doing what I'm doing. You're fooling yourself into believing that it wasn't at one point an animal.
Well, no, I know. I'm not fooling myself.
You're just choosing not to think about it.
I know a guy in Ireland who claims, this has been a while ago, that he could tell what county the sheep or the lamb was raised in.
Just by the taste?
By the taste of it.
By the color.
Right.
That's impressive.
Well, we were eating corned beef last night, and we never eat corned beef. I'm like, why are we eating corned beef? You know, I guess it's St. Patrick's Day week or whatever. It was on sale, and it's pink, right? I mean, it's kind of pinky.
Yes.
And my son's like, does this come from? We're like, really? I go, a goat.
Mary, the first time you saw him eat what is, again, traditionally finger food with a fork, did you call him out on it and say, hey, what are you switching over? What happened to you? What are you doing?
I don't know if it was a one-time thing. All of a sudden, he was just doing it. And I don't know if he got a germ thing going or what.
Is it the mess? Because Dave Emmett said he eats chicken wings with a fork.
No, I don't think it's the mess. I don't.
Is that
know.
For the workout in it? What does he do?
He said he didn't like to get all messy.
Yeah.
My parents had a friend, Tony, who would eat French fries with a fork, and it just baffled me. Like, anytime we didn't eat out with him a lot, but whenever we did, I would watch him fry by fry with a fork, and I would just say, eliminate the middleman or middle fork in this point. Just pick it up and put it in the ketchup if you like and then eat it.
It's more well-mannered, though, don't you think, if you're using a fork?
It is more well-mannered, but it didn't read that way when you'd watch it. It read fastidious. It read just like, oh, wow. Why are you eating them that way? It doesn't make any sense.
Now that I think about it, my husband eats peanuts with a spoon.
What? All right, that's weird.
Yeah, that one's gone too far, Mary.
All right, I need to know. You open up a jar of peanuts, he sticks the spoon in there?
Yeah, that no one does that.
If there's a bowl of peanuts, will he get a spoon and take...
I don't think he'll eat it. I don't know. No, he does do that, but I caught that. That just started like a year
ago. Okay, that's weird.
That just started... He's getting weird. He's in his old age.
Will he take ribbing about it if you call him out on it? Will he accept the fact that he knows it's odd?
Yeah, oh yeah.
He does. Okay.
Well, good, because she's talking about it all morning.
Everybody's going to know now.
A lot of people might have backed off after the first assault, but here she's back for more.
Well, he threw me under the bus this morning, so payback.
Peanuts with a spoon,
that is
really weird.
That's what I said.
Yeah, that's strange. Very strange.
Okay, I don't think I'm making it to 35 years.
You're so close, Mayor.
You know. All right,
we'll take a break. We'll get you some news with a spoon, and then there's a lot more show ahead.
You know what I used this morning? My Quip toothbrush. I love it. It was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even more enjoyable. Quip has sensitive sonic vibrations. It's gentle enough on your sensitive gums. And people brush too hard. Some of those electric toothbrushes out there are just way too abrasive.
Quip also, by the way, has a 2-minute timer built in, and it pulses every 30 seconds, which will remind you when you need to switch sides, helping guide you for a full and even clean. Brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule that's every 3 months for just $5.
3 out of 4 of us use bristles that are old, worn out, and flattened. That's ineffective. It's so easy to switch out the new brush heads. There's a little chart that tells you how to do it. I just did it a few weeks ago. We love Quip. That's why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals.
Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/BillandWendy right now, you get your first refill pack absolutely free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack for free at getquip.com/BillandWendy. When you came into the office this morning, into our office, not here in the studio, but in the office, either Jasmine or I asked how things are going, and you groaned and you said, I needed more sleep. This daylight saving time thing is not working for me.
I cannot stand to give up an hour.
Just an hour? Is that too much?
Yeah, to set it back, I woke up on Sunday morning, and, you know, your clocks pretty much all change themselves. I did have to do the microwave, the clock I made.
It's a miracle.
It is.
Almost all your clocks, whatever you have, your timekeeping device on your phone certainly changes by itself. On your computer, it does. Some of the ones around the house, the one on our bedside does. But yeah, you're right. There's always a couple that don't have the technology.
Right. So I woke up what I thought was 7:45, and it was already 8:45. And it's like, oh, God, I lost an hour.
Yes.
And then, although I have to be honest with you, why do you laugh at me, Bertrand? I heard him grumbling.
Steve is laughing by proxy through me.
I just...
It's just an hour.
Yeah, but I need
more
sleep.
Do you get the same amount of sleep every night?
I go to bed usually sometime about 12 or 12:30, and I get up at 6:30. And honestly, that's not enough sleep for
me. Right.
I need 8 hours. I'm never getting it. So I take a little nap. Mm-hmm. And today is National Nap Day.
I'll look over and I'll go, uh-oh.
Even when I'm talking.
Yeah, right. I don't know anyone else who can do that.
Don't mind Wendy. She's napping. We heard her.
Well, today, is it National Nap Day, Jasmine, or International? Today,
national.
National. Other countries think it's silly.
Well, the whole national blah, blah, blah day is stupid. And the only reason it's nap day is because we lost an hour. And why do we still lose an hour? Are we one of the few states that still do this?
No, they do it across the country.
I don't know. 70 countries around the world practice daylight savings time. All right.
Saving.
It says daylight saving.
There's one of Bill's quirks pointing that
out. Saving. Daylight saving.
Yeah. Right.
I said savings?
Yeah.
Okay, because just my head wants to go there because I've called it that my whole life.
I couldn't care less.
It was implemented during the Second World War. When the U.S. was not at war, the states did what they wanted with daylight saving, choosing whether and when to change their clocks, but that became a little confusing.
Each state decided individually?
Yes. But then came the Uniform Time Act of 1966.
Oh, what an act that was.
This did exactly as its name implied, imposed a uniformity of time observance across the country. As it stands, daylight saving time begins at 2 a.m. local time on the second Sunday in March.
Mm-hmm.
Clocks spring forward an hour, and then it ends at 2 a.m. local time on the first Sunday in November when clocks fall back by an hour.
Which is an expansion because it used to be
October,
right.
End of October.
April.
Right.
And the
So I saw a story on that this weekend because, you know, everyone's saying, let's just get rid of it and keep the hour extra hour of daylight in the evening.
Yeah.
But one of the arguments against it, which you don't think about a lot, is that...
Golfers.
No.
I was just going to say, I'll bet everything I own, it's not golfers. Do you think it was golfers?
No. I was not at golfers.
It's not golfers.
No. It's gophers.
Gophers.
It would be darker so much later in the morning for much of the year.
Yes.
Who cares?
Well, kids would be going to school in the dark. They said that it could really lead to a lot more accidents. It would be less safe. Because, you know, we think of it being the hour like, you know, it was daylight, what, at 6:30 yesterday?
Yes.
Or last Friday. But during the darkest part of the winter, you know, it might not be getting daylight till 8:30, 9 o'clock in some parts of the country.
That's a big deal.
That makes a difference.
I guess. Like that it's, I mean, it was pretty wild looking out last night. It was 7 o'clock, a little after 7, and it was still light
out. Right.
And
right,
I know
right.
In the summer, it gets like 9:45, you can still have some light.
Mm-hmm.
Today, most of Arizona, except the Navajo Nation, Hawaii, the Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and the U.S. Virgin Islands do not change their clocks.
Well, what's going on in Indiana where everybody decides personally whether or not they want it to be an hour before or an hour after?
I don't understand a lot about Indiana.
Nobody does.
I have relatives who live there, and I really don't understand
right.
it. But, and yet it's right there.
But you know the whole state isn't... You know
yeah,
that, right?
I know.
There's, there's towns where it's 6 o'clock here and it's 7 o'clock across the street in Indiana.
So if you're in one town and you drive home and say you leave at 4 o'clock...
Right.
You get home and it's 5.
An hour before you left. Yeah.
Or an hour later. See, this whole time-space continuum confuses me.
It's crazy. But you're a proponent of do away, have
it
be one uniform
time. Like, keep it now.
Throughout the year.
Yeah. Just keep it now. Because now, you know, I know when the seasons change.
But then every time there is an accident, an early morning accident, like Steve pointed out, you'd be to blame. People would say Wendy was the one who decided that it has to be one time, and now it's too dark, no one can see in the morning.
Even though I would like an extra hour, we don't have to fall back. Why don't we just stay sprung ahead forever?
I'd be okay with it, but I do agree with what Steve said, is that it would make traveling dangerous for school kids for part of the year.
In the winter, yeah.
In the winter. Right, right, right.
When they go to school.
Right.
But then they're coming home and it's dark. So, I mean, either way, just shorten the school day. There you go!
Oh, problem solved.
Go to school in the summer.
No. How about that, though? They have proposed many times about, hey, should we do a full year? And when my kids were in elementary school, I was all for it. Because if you have two working parents,
mm-hmm.
that's awesome mm-hmm. if they're at school all day.
Right.
The whole year.
But didn't you, like, most of what got me through every school year was knowing I had X amount of days until summer vacation. You needed that carrot dangled in front of you to get through the year. Although I had cousins who went to school year-round for a while.
You did?
In Florida,
when you were your age? I mean, when you were young?
Yeah, when I used to be my own age. and they liked it.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Shorter day,
I
bet. I bet it's a way shorter day.
I don't remember if it was a shorter day. I remember they had more, you know how like during the school year you have winter break, you have spring break.
Yeah.
They had more of those like a week off here and there. But I couldn't have pulled off school all year round. There's no way.
Well, unless you're like me who does not appreciate anything.
Yeah.
The summer was too short.
Yeah, 90 days is not enough.
It's just not
enough.
Shorter
it's now.
Shorter, way shorter.
It's a week or two shorter.
I just, you know, hope everybody had an okay time waking up. I know it was an hour earlier, technically, but in my thoughts, it wrecked your pattern. So maybe it was easier getting up today. Do you know what I mean? Because you're, you know, like
no,
I get
absolutely
up.
Absolutely no one knows what you mean.
6:30 is when I usually get up. Yeah. Today it was technically 5:30 when
right.
I got up.
Right.
So it got me out of my pattern, and it was actually a little easier waking up today.
That's why they do it Saturday into Sunday. Whoever thought of that
yeah.
is very smart.
Although they said the Monday after the clocks changed, there's a high incidence of stroke, heart attacks. So take a nap today, people. It's National Nap Day.
You owe it to yourselves.
Nap you during my part of
yes.
the show.
Yes. All right, we'll take a break. We'll get you some news, and then there's plenty of show ahead. Stick around. It's Bill Huff. It's Wendy Snyder, and it's WGN.
I remember there was one year that all my friends went away somewhere for spring break, and I stayed home, and it was like 86 degrees here
oh, wow,
during
nice.
Spring break.
I'm going to Mexico next week.
Are you really?
Yeah.
I got to go somewhere. I'm hankering for some sand.
Go with Steve.
Yeah.
We're full.
Oh.
You know, you guys both
very
suck.
Very accommodating, Steve.
Honestly, we'd love to have you.
Why do you say that?
Because
it's true, but why do you say
if
that?
If I ran right. into you guys somewhere,
yes.
I would be like, oh, God, so nice to see you.
Yeah.
We would do that for you.
Yeah.
You'd fake it. Bill
no,
wouldn't even.
No,
Bill wouldn't
I
say,
would.
Terry, turn the other way. I think that's Wendy.
No.
Oh, no, it's just James Spader.
I would definitely say hello to you and then tell you we're going to a different beach.
Yep.
Whatever. All right. Well, I want to be nice to people, unlike these two that I work with.
I think Bill and I are really very nice to most people.
Almost everybody.
Yeah.
Most people.
Right.
Yeah, okay, whatever.
You have to be selective.
All right, I need to... I can't find it now, Bill, and it was really exciting news.
I think I can help you out. Some listeners are celebrating.
It.
Oh, you got it? Okay, go
today,
ahead.
Hey, WGN, today's my parents' 30th anniversary. My mom is a huge fan of your station, and she's listening to you guys live via the app. I love it, WGNradio.com. Could you give Dawn and David Kolesny a happy 30th anniversary shout-out? It would make her day.
I think we could do that, sure.
So happy 30th.
Happy 30th.
We like the Kolesnys.
Yes.
Dawn and David Kolesny,
yep.
If I'm saying that right. I could never be a teacher
because
I would always screw up the kids' names.
That's what's holding you back, huh?
Yeah.
The names?
Okay, I'm going home.
No. He said that with love.
Right.
That was said with love. Did you ever notice, and I don't know if all teachers did this, but I caught a couple of teachers doing this, like when the year would start and all of a sudden the teacher has 30 new kids in their class, and a lot of times that's multiplied by several classes, so all of a sudden you have to learn, you know, 90 or 120 names in a short span of time. I noticed that a couple of teachers had these seating charts, like on their desk, with the kids' names and where they sat, so they would just quickly glance down. And they would say, yes, I will call on you, Stephen Baker, you know, because they saw
right.
it on the list. Like, at first, I was very impressed that the teacher could just memorize everybody's name so quickly, but it turned out some of them were using a cheat sheet.
All of them, I'm sure.
Probably most of them, yeah. Probably most
I never
of them.
Again,
thought
a chapter from the world of Bill Left
well,
you. That this is something that
was,
stayed with you.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's not a bad thing.
No,
but how would it look if the teacher didn't know anybody's name ever? You, the girl with the red hair. Go ahead. You answer.
It's
you,
just,
the guy with the tall guy. With yeah.
Most of us live our lives and we have those realizations and they don't stick with us, but they stick
I
with
I won't
you,
let it go.
You yeah. remember it.
Right.
Where were you in class when it happened?
Well, I remember having to bring up an assignment and the teacher was like hiding it. Like, oh, you're not supposed to know I have a cheat sheet, but I could see it under her arm that she
well,
had.
You thought less of her?
I got to be honest, I did.
Because I would think more of her that... You know, it just means so much more when someone says your name.
Sure.
So,
no, without a doubt it does. But wouldn't that lesson, wouldn't you just say to yourself, oh, I really thought that they were studying up on our name.
I thought they did.
Out,
I didn't know they had a seating chart until you bring it up now.
Yeah.
And now, duh, of course they did.
They had
you
to.
You could have been a teacher.
You could still be a teacher, Wendy.
Bertrand, I would shut up right about now.
No, but you could. I'm saying you could overcome it.
Right. Right.
Now he's backpedaling. His voice went up. Did you hear that? I couldn't tell if it was you or Bill.
Everybody knows you could be a teacher.
You could be.
I wanted to be a PE teacher for a while.
And what changed your mind?
I don't really
The towel
know.
Snapping? The excessive towel snapping?
No.
The uniform?
I don't know what changed my mind. And I wanted to be a psychologist, too.
Oh.
And then I thought, oh, radio. I can do both.
Yes.
Be on a softball team with Bill Leff when he takes you out when you're pitching.
Not that you hold a grudge.
How many years ago did that happen?
That was 20-some years ago. But it was like, you know, and I use this term lightly, loosely, rather, a celebrity softball game. People didn't care if they won or lost except for Bill. And I was pitching like crap that day, and he took me out. And pulled an intern in.
Because if a pitcher is pitching like crap, your own words, the what you want to do is leave them in the game.
So maybe he did you a favor.
I did do you a favor.
I didn't care if I, you know.
Your ERE was triple digits.
You weren't that great that day either. I know Yes better than me.
Three home runs in that game.
What company is
like
the intern
you,
running
three home
never
runs
can
in that
forget
game.
That, can you?
But it's so funny. You go to the story all the time and
I
the
don't even really, I swear I don't even care. It's just funny.
Were you playing it?
If that's the worst you've done to me, really, that's not that bad.
That's not the worst. What, Steve? What
were you playing with the home run fence? We used to play games at Thillin's.
Thillin's was the best.
You hit a home run, man, that felt good.
Did you ever go there?
I don't think so.
It was like a little miniature Major League Baseball stadium. It's gone now, right, Steve? It's no longer
I'm not 100% sure. My
with
son
the
played there 10 years ago.
There was a lady that used to do like a charity softball game every year.
Oh, okay.
And it was always people from TV and radio. And then there was always one or two really big stars. Like one year I played and Jackie Chan was on one of the teams.
Every year
was he good?
Wow.
No, he was horrible.
Did you take him out?
No. He wasn't that bad. he was so polite though. Like when they would get him out at first. He would, like, after the... All right, so let's say he had a ground ball to the third baseman. Third baseman would scoop it up and throw him out. He would bow to the first baseman and then walk over to the third baseman, and he would bow to him as if to say, you both made an excellent play, and I was
wow.
out. Yeah, I never saw anything like that.
Matt Bobala just texted that Thillin's is still there.
Is it really?
Yeah.
But I was talking about the Radio League. That was, like, California and somewhere...
Yeah, right.
Horner Park.
That
was fun.
Horner on the corner. That's how I remembered it.
Yeah.
Being a suburbanite and all, it was hard to get there.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
but the game that we played, that Q101 game, that was at University of Chicago, right?
Yeah,
that was at their stadium. There was a huge crowd for that.
Wow. It must have been embarrassing when he pulled you.
Yep.
It was embarrassing.
I don't know who died and made him coach.
Everyone on the team's looking at each other like somebody has to do this.
Stop
please
it.
Put Wendy out of their misery. Please. Right. Who's brave enough to tell her that she can't pitch anymore? And I said, can't pitch anymore.
Do you remember the intern who replaced you?
I don't remember. I just like to bug. I think Bill really did the right thing, but I know you have to feel a little bad about it. They weren't there to see a win. They were there to see us.
While racing, you have to shoot the horse. I shot the horse.
You're telling me to pull back?
Really? All right.
All right. We must take a break.
That was terrible.
I'm a little hoarse. We'll take a break, and then there's more show. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
I would pitch 100 pitches until Bill Leff takes me out the
mound. Your pitch count was a little high that day. A little pitchy. Dog, D-A-W-G. Do you know what I saw?
Tell me.
I finally saw Free Solo. Have you seen this yet?
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Free Solo.
Yeah, not Han Solo. You probably saw Han
What's
Solo.
What's Free Solo?
Free Solo is the documentary that everybody I know who saw said, you must see this, right? It's about these guys who are mountain climbers.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't use any traditional tools that a mountain climber would use. They just use their hands and their feet and their bodies to scale up gigantic mountains. And you look at these things and you say, nobody could you couldn't climb that with with the traditional tools. Who would do that? And yet there's this guy who does this quite regularly. He's the best in the world at it. So they follow this guy.
Alex Honnold?
Yeah, Alex Honnold. He is fearless, and usually if you say that about somebody, you're exaggerating to some extent. They did a brain scan of this guy, of Alex. They brought him in because the filmmaker said, how could anybody do this? Like, for me, I couldn't even look up at the mountain, much less climb the mountain.
Although you are really afraid of heights, aren't you?
I have a fear of heights. I think everybody, to some extent, has a little bit of it. Some of us have a greater amount of it. So they do a brain scan of this guy, and it turns out you have two parts of your brain towards the front center that light up when you're afraid of something. They light up on when they're testing your brain. There's these. It looks like a thunderstorm. With him, he doesn't have that. He has zero fear.
So they were showing him scary things, like a picture or video, yeah. And there was no adrenaline rush or no
reaction whatsoever.
Really?
Zero. I've never seen anything like it. And they said everybody has varying degrees of it, but with him, it just doesn't register. So even when he climbs these giant mountains, they're all different. Some of them are kind of just flat. Some of them have little summits. When he gets up to a level, he just walks around on the edge of it like it's nothing. Like I would say, once you got to a safety zone, move inward a little bit.
Yeah.
Don't be hanging out on the edge like that. But he walks to the edge. He looks over. He takes pictures. There's no fear at all. I've never seen anything like it before.
But that's something that I think could end up hurting you if you have no fear.
Well, they show the other guys that are great at the sport.
Yeah.
And one by one by one, they fell off the mountains. They just
and
all
he
died. And they would say to him, they go, hey, your friend or this guy that you used to climb with or a guy that you admire, did you see he, 32 years old, he dropped. This other guy, 41 years old, he dropped. And his answer was, well, that's what happens.
Wow.
It's crazy. It's so good. Now, one of my friends saw this on an IMAX screen.
Oh, I think I'm sick.
Wendy, I'm telling you, I'm watching it at home in my living room and I'm holding on to the edge of the chair on a screen that's, a normal-sized TV, on an IMAX screen, I couldn't have watched it.
I would have had to close my eyes.
It was so scary.
I was just watching the trailer, and they have him climbing up the side of a mountain that looks just like a cement street. There aren't like those big...
Flat.
Yeah. I mean, like, a rock climbing wall, there's those little nibs that are sticking out. He was just putting his fingertips up against a flat mountain.
I know.
What is this guy, nuts?
They show him training for... There's one in particular that it's the end of the movie. I'm not going to give anything away. So they show how he trains for it, and he memorizes every single bend and dip in the entire mountain. These are thousands of feet high, and he does practice runs with ropes and with regular traditional tools, and then he does it on his own. But he memorizes, he takes notes... And then he memorizes the notes that at certain amount of feet, there's a dip that goes to the left a little bit, or there's an edge that sticks out a little bit. And he uses that. And it's so scary to watch because, honestly, as he mentioned several times in the movie, if I make a mistake, I drop and it's done.
Okay, so something you have a passion for, it's like if he does drop, do you say he died doing what he loved doing? Because I don't think that matters.
Well... It's
falling.
Falling definitely matters, but I mean.
I don't think like people.
Do you get credit for that?
No, yeah. I mean like he doesn't love falling. He died falling.
Right,
he died doing what he loves doing. Falling.
The climbing part is what he loved. The falling part he didn't.
He seems to be aware. I don't have any ropes here. This is just a practice run, and I'm already like sick to my stomach because they show like this ravine and everything.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God. But, I mean, so he has ropes on. That's his practice. But then I'm just saying if he goes up and does it free form without the ropes and he falls and dies, I guess you're not mad at yourself if you're dead.
Well, during every practice that they show him, there's always a place somewhere that doesn't go well that he falls.
Yeah.
But he's got the rope to, so he falls 20 feet and then he goes, wow, I have to remember that part is there's a divot there for next time. And that wouldn't be how I would react. I'd be like, oh, this isn't meant to be. I can't.
Yeah.
This is not good. Did you see it, Steve?
No.
You've got to see this movie.
So I'm just thinking a really weird thought, talking about quirky things before.
Yeah.
If you could experience the fall without the death.
Yes.
That's bungee jumping.
No, because I always wonder what people think.
Right before they...
Yeah.
I do too, Steve.
Between the fall and the death.
I bet part of it is I should not have done this.
I don't think you're thinking.
You're not?
I think it's just a reaction. How can you be thinking? You're falling. You just... And it goes so quickly that I don't think you're sitting rubbing your chin going, I really screwed up here. Boy, I should have been nicer to my wife this morning.
I bet it doesn't go as quickly as you think.
I bet it takes forever. I don't know, man. That's weird you and I think that because I've often thought about, cause there have been a lot of people jumping to their death. You think of 9/11 and it's like, God, what?
But the difference is 9/11, there was no, whoever fell to their death that day, they weren't part of the bargaining agreement that made them fall. With this
guy,
anybody else who does this sport, you really are responsible.
Yes,
you were the one who decided,
that's true,
I got to climb up the side of that mountain.
And you don't got to.
You don't have to
at all.
You don't have to.
There's never a more certain moment, I would think, in your life than that.
Right.
You know.
You're not going to survive it.
Right.
Right.
And you're conscious and it's...
He was not bothered. The only... I don't want to give too much away, but he has a girlfriend and he doesn't want her to be... Like when he climbs the big mountain at the end, he doesn't want her to be there because he doesn't want her, if something goes wrong, to see that happen. You know, and I give him credit for that.
Was she cool with him doing it?
No.
Because I would have been like,
no.
You know what, I'm your girlfriend now, but if you do this.
And he even, like, there's a time they meet, he's doing a book signing somewhere, and they don't show that part, but all of a sudden he's got this girlfriend, and they explain how it happened. And he says of her, because they go out on a climbing expedition one day, and she's way, way up there. She's not as good. She's not anywhere near as good as he is. But she is really up there, and he said, you know, this isn't really her thing. She's just doing this for me. She's not great at it and stuff. And I'm like, she's way up there. I don't think I could do 10 feet on one of those mountains.
Have you ever done a rock climbing wall?
No. At my health club, there's stairs right next to the wall. You go, if I needed to get up there, I'd just take the stairs in the elevator. Why would I bother with the wall? And I even said to my wife, I go, I've chosen sports where if I make a mistake, like when I play ping pong, if I make a mistake, the mistake is I swung at the ball and I missed the ball. If he makes a mistake in his sport, he falls 35,000 feet.
Yeah, your mistakes are not life and death.
No.
Good for you picking sports that don't have
that
the life
safe.
And death things.
Right, 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 right. But please, see this. You can't believe how gripping it is. Through the whole movie, I'm holding on to the chair. Just like I'm moving my body like tilt this way. You got to tilt that way. It's not good.
I can't make it through. I used to get sick to my stomach watching NYPD Blue. This is going to be way worse.
Way worse. Way, way worse. It's Free Solo, if those of you. It's about. I don't know if it's on HBO yet, but on a lot of cable or satellite systems, they have that thing where you can buy it early, before it comes out. So. All right, coming up, the stories that matter with Steve Bertrand from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio.
Thank you, Steve. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder, WGN Radio. And with the shocking news last week that Alex Trebek just said he is going to fight his pancreatic cancer, we had so many questions about pancreatic cancer. Some of the things I might have said may have been false. I said that usually it's found when it's already in a later stage of it. There aren't that many symptoms.
Yeah.
But we figured we'd go to an expert. And so we have Dr. Arlene D'Souza on the line with us, medical oncologist at Northwestern Medicine, Northwestern Medicine Del Nor Hospital. Dr. Arlene D'Souza, thank you for being on with us, first of all.
Oh, you're welcome.
It was pretty shocking news to hear Alex Trebek, stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and we have a bunch of questions about this. Stage 4 is something, what I've heard is that there aren't that many symptoms, so usually when pancreatic cancer is found, it's usually in that later stage. Is that true?
That's true, and to back up, because I think that not everyone knows what stage 4 means, essentially it means that it's spread beyond the pancreas to other organs. And I think that one of the reasons that pancreatic cancer is such a scary disease is because it is quite aggressive, and it has very vague symptoms. So when people typically do end up going to the doctor, they end up being at a later stage where a curative option isn't available to them.
Who is most susceptible to this type of cancer, doctor?
Well, there are certain risk factors that some people have. So maybe 5 to 10% of patients have some sort of genetic risk. But the remainder of patients can have risk factors like, you know, cigarette smoking. Our Western diet is a risk factor, so high in meats, smoked and processed foods, alcohol, and people with high BMIs and who have a high caloric intake. Those are risk factors, but we often see patients who don't have any of these risk factors who continue to get diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So it's not definitive that one of these things would cause it.
You mentioned the smoking, the junk food, a high BMI. Aren't these a lot of the risk factors for almost all the types of cancers?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. So these are pretty nonspecific. So that means that if, you know, just doing these things doesn't obviously make you certain to have pancreatic cancer, but they are kind of the things that we have identified as being associated with an increased cancer risk.
What are some of the symptoms that people should be looking for?
Well, and you've touched on this as well, that the symptoms are relatively vague. So the most common symptoms that people have are a loss of appetite, unintentional weight loss over the course of a few months, and pain. So this can be pain in the abdomen, or it can even be back pain. Sometimes people present with something called jaundice, so when their skin turns yellow. And often it's seen by lab abnormalities, like elevated liver function tests on routine lab work.
Now, I know with my dad was a childhood diabetic. He only lived till he was 46 years old. I know the pancreas has something to do with diabetes. Are you finding out that there's any connection between a diabetic and someone who has pancreatic cancer?
So they do say that some people with diabetes have an increased risk of developing pancreatic cancer, but we also see that people who are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, when you kind of look at them, that they have often been diagnosed with diabetes in the past several years. So there's some ongoing studies suggesting that, you know, in our older patients who are thin and maybe without any risk factors, if they're newly diagnosed with diabetes, that we should maybe take a closer look and make sure that there isn't something else going on.
How many annual cases of pancreatic cancer are there in the United States?
About 56,000 a year, and among men and women, it's fourth leading cause of cancer death. So it is pretty common, actually, and it is a very, you know, scary disease that affects many of us.
Split up fairly evenly, doctor, between men and women, or not so much?
I think it's a little bit more among men than women, but I think the numbers are coming closer together.
And what about age group? I mean, is it something that you notice later on in life, or can young people get this?
So less than age 45 is relatively uncommon, but after that you see a big spike in the numbers, and even, you know, in the 40s and 50s, it's less common than people older than that. So as we age, it does become more common.
Can we go back just for a second to your last answer? I've heard other doctors say, not just of pancreatic cancer, but other cancers and heart attacks, heart ailments, that it was once dominated by men, and now as time goes on, it's become more of a 50-50 proposition. What's causing that?
You know, I'm not sure that we know. It might be lifestyle modification. You know, in terms of things like tobacco use, you know, men are smoking less, and women these days are smoking a little bit more. So you never know if it's kind of those non-specific lifestyle modifiers that are kind of evening out the playing field a little bit.
Yeah, and think about it. More women have careers and are working full-time as opposed to stay-at-home moms. So when you have that, you have more stress.
Yeah.
So,
And more, you know, maybe higher caloric intake, maybe eating more of those processed meats, and, you know, kind of like the high BMIs and things like that as well.
All right, so Alex Trebek was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, 78 years old. He says he's going to fight it. The treatment has got to be pretty rough.
You know, so the chemotherapy is you know, it's really hard for some people. It's not that hard for other people. It kind of depends on how functional you are prior to beginning in terms of kind of how well we anticipate people doing. So, you know, people who are in good health, who haven't lost a ton of weight, who are pretty active, tend to do better than people who kind of come in very frail and weak. But, you know, I would certainly say chemotherapy is not easy, and you know, it does come with its fair share of toxicity.
He said he announced last week that his plan is to continue to work throughout his fight. Is that a doable thing? Can you conceivably work while you're battling something like this?
I think you can. And again, it depends on kind of how hard it does hit you, the chemo that you're getting. But a lot of my patients are able to work on a nearly full-time schedule when they're getting their treatment. So I do believe that, you know, there's a good chance that he might be able to continue to do that.
Okay.
Dr. Arlene D'Souza, a medical oncologist at Northwestern Medicine at the Northwestern Medicine Delnor Hospital. What are his chances of survival? I mean, what about the treatment? How effective is that?
Well, that's a good question. So I think that if you look at the numbers, you know, the 5-year overall survival rate is pretty dismal. It's less than 5%. So most people, truthfully speaking, don't live that long. But, you know, there are newer combinations of chemotherapy that are extending people's lives. So, you know, one of the news articles that I read, it said that he was hoping to live about 3 years. I mean, I think that's ambitious, but with our new treatments, that's, you know, certainly reasonable to be hopeful for, you know, to live over a year, maybe two, even three.
And both Bill and I lost our moms to cancer, different types. But I know that when my mom had cancer, she went to this seminar that tried to give her this positive mental attitude, to treat the cancer as the little dots in Pac-Man, and you are Pac-Man going through and just destroying it. How important is a positive mental attitude for fighting cancer?
You know, I think it's really important, and I see that with my patients. You know, I think you could never fault somebody for, you know, for getting very down and kind of becoming overwhelmed with their diagnosis. But I see that people with really good family support and people who are, you know, super motivated, a lot of my patients kind of turn to yoga and meditation to help them get through it. I find that they do very well, and I don't underestimate how the power that kind of positive mental attitude and good family support plays.
A texter, Robert, wants to know if this type of cancer, pancreatic cancer, is particularly painful, doctor. Is it?
It is. So, you know, I said one of the side effects are relatively nonspecific, but one of the most common side effects is just a vague pain in your abdomen. Sometimes it goes to your back. People have a hard time describing it, but it feels kind of like an ache often. And, you know, as the cancer progresses and gets worse, this pain can become quite an issue. So that's kind of one of our focus whenever we take care of these patients, to make sure that, you know, during the course of their disease, that we manage their pain and make sure that they're as comfortable as possible.
Say again, you said it feels like what initially? You broke up for just a second. What is it?
Sorry about that.
That's right.
So it's a vague abdominal pain. So sometimes people say, you know, sometimes they say it doesn't hurt. It just feels uncomfortable. It's just kind of this funny feeling in their stomach. And I think that, and some people say it's a sharp pain in their belly. Sometimes it goes straight to their back. So it's different for everybody, but I think that that's kind of part of the reason why identifying the symptoms of pancreatic cancer is so hard, because it's so different in each person.
So for most of us, what do we need to do? Is there a screening process that we should go in every year, every 5 years, to have them look at us? What do we do?
Unfortunately, there isn't. And I think that's kind of part of why pancreatic cancer is so aggressive, because there's no standard screening for kind of members of the general population. Now, if you have a first-degree family member who was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, more and more patients are kind of are seeing a genetic counselor to see if they have some sort of mutation that might require that they would get screening. And screening would include maybe imaging of the pancreas as well as endoscopic evaluation. So that's the tube going down your throat and kind of looking around to see if there's any masses within the pancreas. So that's not the standard of care, but if you have a positive family history for it, like multiple members of your family have it, this might be something that would apply to you.
The treatment of cancer and cancer research has just come such a long way, and I know each and every day there's more and more that's found out about curing this terrible disease. How do you determine, and I know that it comes to an oncologist like you, but how do you determine whether or not it's radiation or chemo or the combination of the two?
So I think that it's based on kind of the characteristics of the tumor. So
I think we lost her. Dr. Arlene D'Souza. Well, she's gone but not forgotten.
Oh, okay.
We are going to take a quick break. Are you back, doctor?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Sorry, yeah. Yes. I guess this will be our last question, just determining whether or not you get chemo or radiation or both.
So I guess to answer quickly, if the cancer's in a lot of locations, like if it's in your liver or in your lungs or throughout your belly, then chemo makes sense. If it's localized to just the pancreas, is then we always do chemo, but we decide, you know, if it's in kind of just a few spots, if radiation could be helpful.
And surgery, is that sometimes helpful?
Surgery is your best chance of cure. So for the 15 to 20% of people who have localized disease, meaning it's just in the pancreas, surgery is actually the standard of care, followed by chemotherapy or with chemotherapy.
And someone, we don't have time to take it, but can you get a pancreatic transplant? Is that in the works or in the making?
No, not at this time.
It's really a terrible news that we heard about Alex Trebek, 78 years old. His contract expires in 3 years. He doesn't plan to expire before that.
Him.
So fight it and do your best. Dr. Arlene D'Souza, medical oncologist at Northwestern Medicine Del Nor Hospital, and that's out in Geneva. Thank you so much for answering some of our questions.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you, Doctor. You know, the upsetting part, it's all upsetting, but the worst part of this is that normally if somebody of some stature, somebody of some renown has something, it creates an awareness for it, and you go, well, maybe this will save lives, but because there's little to no screening that can be done, it doesn't really save lives. Because like I said, I asked her that question about what do we do, how do we make sure we don't have it, and it's just not there.
And, you know, then I'm thinking if you're getting your endoscopy, which... sometimes we all have, I had both of them at the same time, just knock it out of the park at the same time.
Yep.
Can they look for that while they're there, even though they don't suspect it?
I don't know the answer to that. It'd be helpful. It'd be handy if they could pull that off. So,
cancer is very scary. And sorry to all the people who have been texting us with not good results, just saying that they've had close friends or family members that had pancreatic cancer, and it wasn't really a very long road after the diagnosis, and quite a painful and crappy one.
Awful.
So sorry about that.
All right, a break and then more shows. Stay here at Bill and Wendy, WGN.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. We were talking about pancreatic cancer, and just, Bill, I'm with you. I haven't heard that being a very common form of cancer, but boy, were we wrong.
It's
rare, but like right. Steve Jobs, Luciano Pavarotti, Patrick Swayze. These are all people that were diagnosed with pancreatic cancer.
Hmm.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So I don't know what stage it was discovered for her.
Right.
Joan Crawford, Jack Benny, Count Basie, Donna Reed, Rex Harrison, Michael Landon, Fred Gwynne, and Henry Mancini.
It's quite a list.
Back a while, too.
It's quite a list. And in some of those cases, like Patrick Swayze, you mentioned a couple names where they were just too young, you know? Patrick Swayze in his 40s? He was in his 40s.
He was really
too young.
At 57.
Was he really? Wow.
Yes.
Remember Michael Landon, when he found out he had it, he did sort of a farewell tour where, you know, he'd show up on The Tonight Show and he would talk about it, and the realization was everyone knew, I'm not going to be here much longer, I'm just kind of saying goodbye. That was tough.
Awareness of the disease helps drive clinical research, which helps find cures or beneficial therapies. And my brother-in-law and my best friend both had pancreatic cancer and are now cancer-free.
So there's definitely
a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
There's a book called The 1 Minute Cure. Check it out. Government doesn't want you to heal yourself. I don't want to get into the government thing. Big pharma and government is keeping us sick and giving us cancer. All right, Rita is on the line with us. Rita, we're trying to find out more about pancreatic cancer. Now, you had or have it?
Yeah, I've had 3 surgeries. I had my first one in 2009. I was sick, talk about not being diagnosed, for almost 8 months before they were able to figure out with a new doctor what was going on. And then I had my next one in 2013 and my last one in June of last year. And of course, the gold standard is to go for the 5 years. So every time that I've gotten close to the 5 years, then it's cropped up again. Now I no longer have a pancreas. I am, for 6 years, I've been a type 1 diabetic. I've only had surgery. I also have another condition that predisposes me to the neuroendocrine, which is the rarer form of the pancreatic cancer. But I've had good health care and a doctor that, you know, he will take cases that other people pass on. And I've been very fortunate. It's not something that you think you're going to have to deal with, but that's what I've done.
How is your health now?
Well, it's okay. I had a diabetic crisis a week ago, but I'm thankful for every day. I try to look at things as sometimes you don't know why stuff happens or why you have it, but there's a reason. And I've met a lot of wonderful people. I've gone to a support group. So you're there for the people that are just starting their journey. And
Well, we should all follow your lead and live each day to the fullest. And please, yeah. God bless. Good luck to you, Rita.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rita. Good luck.
And Cardinal Bernardine also had it.
Oh, he did, didn't he?
Yeah, kind of. We forgot about it. All right, quick break. News time coming up next at 720 WGN.
Zorn, 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 the greatest father in all the land. Zorn, 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 we sing the praises of Zorn.
Yes, we do.
Eric Zorn is here to have his praises sung.
I never get tired of that song. You think I would, but I don't.
It's become, you know how Bob Hope, if you'd show somewhere, show up somewhere, thanks for the memories. Yes. That just became his theme.
It's my hail to the chief.
It's your hail to the chief. What shall we start with, Eric?
Well, I wanted to revisit something we talked about last week a little bit, and I think Jasmine has the tape, the recording queued up, about how frequently Lori Lightfoot, the mayoral candidate, uses the word frankly.
She has a little verbal tic and where she throws in frankly.
These are two sound bites. We got it in there? I'm looking at her. Yes, she's nodding. From the debate Thursday night, which I then want to talk about. But can you play those first?
The challenge also is, frankly, we have far more cars on the street now than we did before. In some instances, I think 10,000 more a day. So we've got to actually do a much more effective job of thinking about, frankly, what's the right level of regulation for the rideshare community. But we also, frankly, have to put people back on the street who know how to manage traffic. Traversing the loop during rush hour, which frankly seems endless now, is virtually impossible. And frankly, I share that view. We've got to make sure that we, frankly, are looking to neighborhoods south of Roosevelt Road and west of Ashland in a way that we haven't, frankly, in the last 7 years.
All right. We get your point.
She
we don't have the other
a lot.
One.
She says frankly a lot. Okay, we've made that point.
But Wendy believes this is an unfair criticism.
She thinks I'm being unfair.
Frankly unfair.
I think, yes, she uses it a lot. I probably have some problems, too, where I say, you know, or, or like, and then if you start picking apart what people say, it really, in the grand scheme of things, doesn't matter that much.
No, it doesn't. Well, this is interesting. I've gotten some response from this. A lot of people saying, like, aren't there bigger issues to worry about? And I say, of course, no.
There are. I'm not sure there are.
Obviously there are. But my point is that when she has this disfluency, when she keeps dropping this word in, it becomes really distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get some feedback on Facebook, like, I'm really sorry that you pointed this out, because now that's all I hear when she talks.
Yeah, so why'd you point it out?
Because it's your job to. Well, it was like several people criticized me, saying that it was either sexist or racist of me to point out, pick on the way an African American woman is talking.
God.
But I have to say that I spent 4 years attacking Bruce Rauner for dropping his G's all the time. I had a thing called the Folksy Meter, which I would count all the words ending in ing in his speeches and count what percentage of them he dropped. We're going to do this,
right?
If you're
going to have one, though, frankly, sounds like you've had some schooling. You know,
it does make you sound smarter.
It does.
I'm going to start adding it to my vernacular.
How about ostensibly?
Oh, that's even better. That's even better.
No, I kind of thought that maybe, because I tweaked her in print about this, that maybe some of her people would say, try to cut back on the franklies. But
do you think if somebody came to you and said, we did a little market research and people are a little bit put off by the fact that you say frankly a lot, so let's hold back. I would almost think that would make her more self-conscious, and you might even hear it more often.
It'd be really difficult to change. I don't know. This is an interesting topic. But to get to the substance of the debate, I should say this, and this was Thursday night on NBC5. Carol Marine, the great Carol Marine, hosted this debate.
Mm-hmm.
And It was very dispiriting. Did either of you? I saw bits and pieces of it
where they were really arguing with one another,
picking at each other, going after each other's past, and not really looking forward that much. That you would ask, they would ask Toni Preckwinkle a question and about what she wanted to do, and she would pivot really quickly to say, "Well, Lori Lightfoot is a corporate lawyer whose law firm defends big tobacco and big pharma and big payday law." I mean, it was one of those things where you think like, "Well, no, we want to know that what you're going to do." And here, the way I look at this race is this: you have two candidates who I think are very accomplished and impressive people. Both of them,
without a doubt,
both of them have resumes that have obviously little things that you might say, give me a little pause. But they are both really, really smart people.
Yeah.
They're both accomplished people. And from my point of view, as someone who leans liberal, they're progressive in nearly every area. I want to know, as a voter, what's the substantive difference between them? I don't want them to say, like, well, you backed Joe Berrios. And, well, your law firm defended someone who was accused of racial discrimination. These kind of things really don't tell me a lot about what kind of mayor they're going to be and what their priorities are going to be and where they're going to make a difference. And this is I think, a problem you see sometimes with the small differences really get people. I mean, these candidates are, like I say, they're both very accomplished people.
Sure.
And toward the end of the debate, Carol Marine said to them something like, well, you know, do you have the confidence that your opponent would be a good mayor if you were to lose? And Toni Preckwinkle starts, and she just like starts going, well, you know, she's in the law firm, and I'm really uncomfortable about all that. What her law firm, but you can't spend all this time being a corporate lawyer and still represent the people the way. And so I'm really uncomfortable with that. Then they ask Lightfoot, and to me, this was just a complete slow pitch on the center of the plate, because Preckwinkle had just proven herself to be really small in that answer. And so Lightfoot had this opportunity to say something like, I respect Toni Preckwinkle a great deal. She has accomplished a great deal in her 30 years in service. I think she would be a good mayor, or even a great mayor. I think I would be a better mayor, and here's why. Instead, of course, all she did was she said, well, you took a donation from my law firm. and the audience kind of went,
oh, here we go.
And it's one of those things where I think, like, I would really like them to start talking about what they want to do with housing, what they want to do with education, what the differences are between them, because that is not clear to me. I cover this stuff. I read about it all the time.
And it's not clear to you.
I can't sit here right now and explain to you the point-by-point differences between them, because so much of this race has been about personality.
Sure.
It's been dragging things down. And politics is tough. It's for sure it's tough. And you have to define your opponent negatively. You have to get people a reason to vote for you and not the other candidate. I get that. But I also want more meat on the bones.
Yeah.
And there is going to be – the Tribune is hosting a debate tomorrow. And I think at 1 o'clock, after you guys are off the stream, all your listeners can go to the Tribune website or the Tribune Facebook page and watch that exchange. It should be pretty interesting. The editorial board will be there. I'll be there. Cass will be there.
Oh, excellent. Very good. All right. Hold that thought. We'll pick this up in just a little bit. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder and Eric Zorn from the Tribune right here on WGN. Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder. Eric Zorn is our guest from the Chicago Tribune. Also, one of the Mincing Rascals, number 3, I believe, the Mincing Rascals.
I think of myself as the second.
The second Mincing Rascal.
Yeah.
All right, here's a question.
Steve Bertrand would fight me for it.
Oh, he'll fight for anything.
He fights with everyone.
He just likes to fight.
He's pugnacious.
Yes, he is. All right, what if there was an election? This is hypothetical. Maybe it's for mayor, maybe it's for governor, maybe it's for president. And one of the candidates said, I'm not going to say anything bad about my opponent. My opponent's done some good stuff in the past, would make a great mayor, would make a great governor, would make a great president. I like to think I'd be a better one, but I'm going to do this whole campaign without bad-mouthing him or her even once. How would that person do?
Well, it would depend on what his or her surrogates did behind the scenes. I mean, a candidate can stay above the fray,
yeah,
especially in a high-profile race, while the people underneath that candidate can be feeding negative information to the media and putting things out. I think it would be possible to have, especially in a race like the Chicago mayor's race right now, to only go positive and to try to, because it is important to talk about, the past of these candidates.
Yeah, sure.
But I do think that it would be possible to go basically positive. The problem is that it becomes so irresistible to try to define your opponent. If you remember, the sort of classic example of this in Illinois was when, I think it was 2006, when Rod Blagojevich ran against Judy Bartopinka.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that was the race. I think that was the year. And you remember Judy.
Sure.
Oh, totally.
Very well.
Was she treasurer, controller? I forget which office she held at the time. I think she was treasurer at the time. But Judy was a West Suburban, you know.
I saw her at a garage sale wanting to know how much the beaver coat was.
How much for that beaver?
I liked her a lot.
Oh, I did too. She had a huge, always carried a huge cup of coffee with her. And
super friendly.
Oh, absolutely friendly. And she was a very moderate Republican. Mm-hmm. And the kind of Republican, frankly, who does well in this state. I said, frankly, did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
She does well in this state, who is liberal in her social views, conservative in her economic views. She was teed up, I think, to do really well. And people really respected her.
Mm-hmm.
And Blagojevich came out of the gate and just hammered at her for having good relations with George Ryan. There was an image or a video of her doing the polka with George Ryan at some state fair or something like that. And the whole theme of Blagojevich's really early, really high dollar campaign was, what is she thinking? Remember that? Do you remember those ads? What is she thinking?
Yes.
Trying to define Judy as a hack and as someone who's unfit to be governor. And remember, Blagojevich was a controversial figure even then. He hadn't been frog marched out of his house yet,
mm-hmm.
but he was still under, you know, people knew he was under investigation. There's some hinky things about him, but that was an extremely successful negative campaign. He defined Judy, and she never had a chance after that. Now, I think that she was in the mold of a Jim Edgar and of a Bruce Rauner too, of these relatively mainstream Republicans who can under optimal circumstances get a lot of votes statewide in Illinois even now. And so you look at that, you say, well, what's the, you know, what is it possible to run just a positive campaign? Yeah, it's possible, but if the second your opponent goes negative on you,
you have to match it.
Respond. You've said, "Well, okay," and it's this, you know, Joe Berrios connections, Joe Berrios and Ed Burke connections that Preckwinkle has, and so she fires back, "Well, look at what your law firm did." Mm-hmm. And before we went on there, you're saying it's like one of those kangaroo fights, you know?
Yeah, they're both moving their little hands at each other, fighting.
Their little hands, and it's really dispiriting as a voter. You want more substance.
Lori Lightfoot had to say that she doesn't want to apologize for being successful. There's something to that. Why should anyone apologize for being successful?
Well, I don't think it's not just that she's successful that Tony Preckwinkle is going after her. It's that her law firm is Mayor Brown. It's one of these big law firms.
Yeah.
They handle all kinds of clients.
Yeah.
And especially when you're looking at the range of clients that a large law firm
represents. Some are less savory than others.
Always. I mean, you don't go to a lawyer because you've been leading this pure and blameless life, generally.
Right.
I mean, you often have some problems that you're dealing with, and lawyers are bound by their oath to represent their clients zealously. Apparently, there was a case, I don't have all the details on this, but that Mayor Brown was defending a company that was accused of racial discrimination. And the plaintiff in the case, who was on the other side of Lori Lightfoot, has ended up endorsing her.
Oh.
Because he felt that she behaved honorably during the course of the case and during the negotiations. And all. So he ended up endorsing her. But so I don't think that Preckwinkle's saying, well, you've made a lot of money, therefore you're not qualified. I think she's saying that the way you made your money with this big white shoe law firm is unsavory.
Right.
I don't think that is
It has nothing to do with anything.
Well, the truth is that Lori Lightfoot is, like I've said this before, she's a very accomplished, very intelligent person, and should be proud of her success, should be proud of what she's done, and also of her public service. She worked in the Daley and the Emanuel administrations, working in monitoring the police department in various capacities, and most people thought she behaved herself with integrity in those jobs.
Willie Wilson endorsed her, Lori Lightfoot. Is he, of the other mayoral candidates that did not make the top two, is he the most important piece?
I think so.
He is, right?
I think it's really important. I don't know the extent to, now, of course, Willie Wilson, he was the businessman, entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And he won 14 wards in the city. He won more wards than anybody else.
Yeah.
And he's very popular in the African-American community. And you've had him on or you've talked to him?
I have not, no.
Ro has.
He is a very engaging guy.
Yeah.
I don't think he belongs anywhere near the fifth floor of City Hall.
Yeah.
I don't think he's got the policy chops, and I don't like some of his other political views, but he's a very nice guy and a very generous man, too, and very successful. He won 14 wards in African-American wards. He has a lot of sway in that community. Now, the question is whether that translates to another candidate, whether he can push his support to another candidate. Dorothy Brown, if you remember, Dorothy Brown, who's mm-hmm. the county clerk, she has a lovely daughter. She is also mm-hmm. very popular. She's also very popular. And she tried mm-hmm. to translate her support by endorsing Amar Enya after Brown got kicked off the ballot for signature problems. And that didn't really work. Amar Enya, I think, finished, fifth or sixth,
yeah.
seventh, maybe didn't. So I don't know that that's going to work. Willie Wilson is a fairly conservative guy. He said he voted for Trump.
Yeah.
He was all behind Bruce Rauner. So it's sort of an interesting signal that the young Republicans of Cook County endorsed Willie Wilson. It's an interesting signal that is being sent that maybe Lori Lightfoot is the more conservative
of the two
of the two candidates. And I think that's probably true in terms of policy. Mm-hmm. Toni Preckwinkle was a member of the original member of the Progressive Caucus in the city council. She voted against this parking meter deal. She was one of, I think, only five aldermen who voted against that parking meter deal that now everybody hates.
Yeah.
So she has some credentials to say that she is the more progressive of the candidates. The question becomes, is she going to be the most effective mayor? So
what do you think is going to change, if anything, about the city of Chicago once one of these women become the new mayor over Rahm Emanuel?
Well, one thing I think could easily change is the way city council operates. That for years now, under Daley, under Emanuel, you've had a city council that defers a great deal to the mayor. That says, you know, who's going to be the chairman of the finance committee? The mayor will tell us and we will put that person in.
Yeah.
And so it's been such a top-down organization.
Yeah.
And it's something that I think really needs to change, because you do have this interesting city council. It's going to be more diverse and it's going to be more progressive than it has been.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to get up on its hind legs. And it's going to, I hope, it's going to assert itself in some ways. And it's going to not just be a rubber stamp for the mayor, which is really what we've had. So the question is, how does that translate to, for instance, the school board?
Right.
Lori Lightfoot wants there to be a fully elected school board. I think this is right. And Toni Preckwinkle wants it to be a hybrid, partly appointed, partly elected. But that's going to change how the schools are run. Lori Lightfoot has said that she's going to put a whole lot of emphasis on crime. She thinks that's the number one issue in the city.
Yeah.
So I think you may see some more outreach, some more attention paid to the neighborhoods, which is going to be really important.
Great. So thank you for stopping by, Eric.
Thank
we'll
you.
See you in a week.
Frankly, I think you're good.
Frankly, this has been a pleasure.
Thanks. Read Eric Zorn in the Chicago Tribune. Coming up, the stories that matter with Don Kleppen from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio.